Dark Reef Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009. This is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 4, delivered on August 27, 2009. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and the Federal Reserve System.
Today, interest rates and the Federal Reserve System. This begins with a very simple math problem that is the window on one of the most important fundamental principles of all of finance. Recall that I told you that debt could be divided into bills, notes, and bonds. And I explained that really any debt instrument that is what we would deal with in a class like this. And in normal financial investment terms, a bond is characterized by its face value, which we will always assume is 1,000 unless I say differently. It's characterized by its face value, which will always be 1,000. And you'll hear me call that face. Sometimes you'll hear me call it par, but that's not exactly correct. But its face, its coupon rate, which is expressed as a percent of face, and its time to maturity. And as a fourth one that the book doesn't talk too much about, at least certainly not now, the book will definitely bring it up in a little while. But there's another one too, which is the covenants of the instrument, the covenants. In other words, are there special provisions in this bond? Callability. Could the borrower, say IBM, call the bond in early and just give you your money back and say, here you go? Like, for example, if the bond is an 8% IBM due in 2029, and the prevailing interest rate environment becomes later such that interest rates are floating around 5% for IBM type risk, well, IBM would really love to get rid of those bonds it's paying 8.5% on and reissue at 5%. If the bond has a callability provision, IBM can do that. It could actually just call in the bond, here's your $1,000 back, and then essentially reborrow, refi. Now, that would be great for IBM, but you would say, well, you know, that really, that goes to www.thissucks.com. Because you were expecting to get 8.5% for all those years, and all of a sudden you got your money back, so you've got to reinvest it. Well, you're probably going to reinvest it at 5%. You won't get that 8% anymore. So the callability provision is adverse to the lender, to the buyer of the bond. And obviously, if the lenders are intelligent, if there's a callability provision, they're going to extract a little bit of blood for that. Oh, you want to be able to call the bond in? Well, you're going to have to pay us a coupon a little above 8% if you want that trick. Other covenants in a bond have to do with things like, another one, a real nasty one, and I brought this up, I believe, on Tuesday, is the convertibility. Some bonds are issued, and under certain conditions, the borrower has the right to convert the debt into common stock. That's not nice. Because common stock, they don't have to pay a dime on common stock. They could pay a dividend if they want, but they don't have to pay a dime. So if a company got really desperate and its cash flow was in a really dire situation and it had convertible debt, it could convert that debt into equity, and then its payments on coupons, its coupon payments are gone. So obviously, if you were to be a lender and you were buying convertible debt, you would want some serious blood for that covenant that is adverse to you. Other covenants have to do with collateralization. A bond that is collateralized, generally you might hear that called a mortgage bond. It's actually, there's something out there that you could take. If they don't pay you, you can take their building. And then there are other ones that are uncollateralized. We would generally call those debentures. Debentures. And I will bring that term up later again. D-E-B-E-N-T-U-R-E-S. Debentures. And also there's seniority of claim. Now there are bonds, if the company goes tap city, if it's a senior debt, you get in line first to take whatever you want. If it's junior, then you're back behind the seniors. Subordinated. It would be subordinated to some claim that was higher on the totem pole. So all of those will affect the risk of lending to the corporation. In real terms, most of the time, if it's a very creditworthy corporation, these risks are small because the company is probably not going to go bankrupt. But then again, in this era, we've got some seriously decent companies that just turn belly up. And that's kind of, that's caused all risk premia, which I'll bring up here in a little bit, to rise somewhat. Just because investors are now a little more skittish, even about very well-heeled companies. When you see companies dying that you wouldn't have expected to die, that kind of makes you a little more skittish about lending, and therefore, as a lender, you will expect a little bit more interest to bear the risk of the lending. But let me take you through something a little strange here. Here in these bills, there's one animal that we call a discount instrument. It is due in 1 year. The government does these. Now, there are versions in the corporate world, too, ZCBs, but I won't get into those. But in the government, they, when they need quick financing, they use a treasury bill. It's a one-year treasury bill. And instead of paying a coupon to you, you buy the treasury bill, this one-year T-bill, at a discount to par, at a discount to $1,000. In 1 year, you'll get $1,000. In 1 year, you'll get $1,000. So what you are doing now is paying something less than $1,000, and when you get your $1,000 back, the spread is the interest you've earned on it. So here we go. Watch. Let me show you. Now here's the price of it. Now, the price is going to be affected by supply and demand dynamics. Supply, how much of this stuff the government is pouring out there, these T-bills. Demand, how many investors are out there who want this stuff. So the price would be affected by supply and demand conditions. Now, let me do something here. Let me write face here, and then the dollar interest here. And finally with this little instrument, which is extraordinarily common, banks hold these, the Fed uses these all the time. They're very common. But finally, we're going to talk about the yield. That's a fancy word for the interest rate. You don't want to say the interest rate. If you go to a finance singles bar, you don't want to say interest rate because you'll never get a date. You have to say yield at a finance singles bar. Okay, really. Yeah, it's important for you to know the terminology. So you got to say yield, but it's just an interest rate. Okay, now I'm going to do one of these little bonds, these little bills here. Okay, I'm going to say, well, let's say that at a treasury auction. Now, it doesn't work this way anymore. It's all electronic. But in an older time, it's the same thing. The treasury would have come once a week, walked up, and it would have had these treasury bills, just laid them out on the table. And then it would have stood there and waited for buyers to come up to the table to buy these things. And that means that by buying it, the money comes to the treasury as a loan. It's literally, if you, sir, go up and buy this, one of these from me, you are lending me, the treasury, money. Okay, so here we go. We got one of these sitting here, and you come up and you're sort of window shopping. You kind of kick the tires of it. And I say, can I help you, sir? I don't know. You look around and you see, there's a lot of people here, so he's probably not going to want to haggle too much. How much did you say this is going to give me in a year? $1,000, sir. Okay, well, you think to yourself, there's a lot of people kind of coming up here, so they're probably, I can't haggle them down on the price. So how about if I offer you $975 for this thing? And I think about it, well, that sounds fair under these conditions, $975. So we have established a price of $975 on this debt instrument. $975. Nothing hard about that. Now, obviously, if there's a lot of demand, the price would be higher. If there's not much demand, the price would be lower. Okay? So, but right now, we're good on this. Okay? Now, everything else here after the price is something that you would know. What's the face value of this instrument? What's the face? Yes, instantly. You will always say face is 1,000. From now until the day you die, even after you're dead, if I walk up to your grave and say, what is the face value from the earth, you will say 1,000. Actually, if you're 6 feet under, so it'll be 1,000. Humorless crowd today. 1,000, look, $1,000. Nothing big here. Okay, now we're ready to finish the problem. Woman, how much interest did I earn? $25. In a year, you get a $1,000 check in the mail. So you say, well, I got $25. Okay, now we're ready to finish the problem. Really easy. Okay, how much interest did she say I earned? $25. How much did he invest? So to find the interest rate, I would take the interest, $25, over the initial investment, which was $975. Okay. That's how you figure how much interest over how much you invested. Don't make it complicated. That's how you do an interest rate. How much interest dollars you earned over how many dollars you invested. And so if I do that, work out 25, and I encourage you, please do this with me so that it's not something that's obtuse to you later. How the hell did he get that number? I get an interest rate of 2.56%. And you might be saying, is finance this easy? Not always. But if you get this, and I do this early simple problem, because like I've said, later the formulas get kind of obtuse and long and confusing sometimes. Really underneath it all, they're just weird variations of what I'm doing here. When I have to deal with multiple cash flows and multiple time dimensions. Here I've got a perfect one-year instrument, so that is definitely an annual interest rate. The annual yield is 2.56%. There we've got the interest rate. Well, now let's do this again. You decide, well, that was a decent investment, so you come up again a year later. Well, I like that investment. So you come up, and here's another treasury auction. You come up, and you're window shopping. And I say, good morning, sir. Welcome back. And you say, well, I think maybe I'd like to buy another one of these treasury bills. That was a sweet investment. You paid me. Well, of course we do. We will not pay you. We will pay. You'll get paid. There's no risk in this instrument. The government will pay you. Even if it has to invade another country to get the money, it'll pay you. It will print the money. Literally, the government will not default. So there's no risk other than an inflation premium. But we'll not talk about that right now. Okay, and you come up. Okay, would you like the $975 special like you did last time? And you look around and you don't see hardly anyone here. And you say, I don't think so. You step back. And I just, fine. Anyone? Anyone? Hello? and we kind of like need our money today. You know. You see, what will happen is that if there is not sufficient demand, he gets market power and he can say, $950. The government has to have its money. It will get its money. Even if I have to bring more of these out and sell more of them because I'm getting less from him, I will do it. That is how the government works. $950, fine, whatever, capitalist. So at this auction we do, oops, $950. Okay. Okay. Here we go again. Madam, what is the face?
1,000.
Oh, that was excellent. Even before I almost finished. 1,000. Nice. What's the interest?
50.
$50. I mean, you're going to you lend me $950 by buying the treasury bill, and you'll get $1,000 back. So there's $50 in it. Okay, so now we can do the yield again. This time, he got $50 on an investment of $950. So now, I invite you to calculate the yield with me. We would have 50 divided by 950, 5.26%. And now there is one of the most important fundamental principles of finance. What happened to the yield as the price fell? Yes, when the price of any security falls, all other things being equal, the yield on it rises. When price falls, yield rises. This could be a simple T-bill, or it could be the most complex bond you could ever want to deal with in a finance class. The relationship will always hold. As the price of the instrument falls, the yield will rise. So as you get a better price, you are get a lower price, you are getting a higher yield on the instrument. Now, this is one of the things that can, even to this day, kind of gets me. When you see the financial press reporting, they say something like, Treasury notes fell. What do they mean? Are you talking about the price fell or are you talking about the yield fell? Normally, they'll be talking about the price falling when they say that. But it's kind of unclear. Usually, they just say, Treasury notes fell today. Well, if that's the price you're talking about falling, that means that the yields on those Treasury instruments were rising, which would mean that overall, look, if you can get invest risklessly from me at 2.56%, then businesses, which would have to put on a little bit more of a risk premium, might at 4.56%. But if the government's yields on government instruments is rising 5.26%, that would mean that the businesses out there would have to offer commensurately more to compete for capital. They would have to offer more. So when you're watching the financial markets, as the prices of treasury instruments falls, that means that the yields on treasury instruments are rising, which means, all other things being equal, that that's a bad sign for the economy, because that would mean that interest rates that businesses have to borrow at would be rising too. Interest rates that businesses would be borrowing at would have to be rising too. And that generally is a bad sign for a couple of reasons. One is, if interest rates are rising, businesses would have, if they borrowed, they would have higher cash outflows. Simple as that. Cash outflow, bad. Cash inflow, good. But there's something else behind it too. And here's where I sneak in a window on you for future reference. Look here. Suppose that you're a business, and you've got some projects that you're considering. Project
and expected rate of return. And we'll do calculations, how you can find the expected rate of return on a project. After all, this is financial management. We'll go through that. But it'd be nice if you knew why you want to get these expected rates of return first. Okay, let's say we've got three projects we're considering right now. The finance jockeys have given us our expected rates of return on these projects. Project A gives us a rate of return of 16%. Project B gives us a rate of return of 6%. And project 3 gives us a rate of return of 4%. We're thinking about these. Now, given that we're credit worthy, we could get the money together for all three of the projects. That doesn't mean we're going to embrace all three of the projects. Let's talk turkey here. Let's talk. And again, I try to invoke just kind of a common sense way of approaching finance and financial management. Look, suppose that we can borrow money at 3% as this company. We can borrow money for projects at 3%. Would I accept project A, which yields 16%, if I can borrow on it at 3%? Oh, yeah, 10-4. How about project B? Yep. C? Oh, yeah, even a low-yielding project. Heck, if I can get money at 3% and I get 4% off, I'll take it. I'm greedy. I'll do it. Sure, I will. Absolutely. But what happens if yields on treasuries go up, which means we have to offer higher yields? Suppose that the interest rate environment goes from 3% up to 5%. Now, would I still take project A? Well, heck, yeah. Would I still take project B? Yeah, I mean, I borrow at 5, I get 6, sure. That's a positive gain. What about C? Nope. In the words of financial media people, business activity is declining. Because the interest rate environment is going up, it's killing off projects. Okay, now, let's say that the interest rate environment rises to 10%. We can borrow money, but it will cost us 10% to borrow it based upon our risk profile. Will I take on A? Yep. How about B? Nope. And C, that's gone home to Jesus. Nope. Business activity has declined even more. Do you see how the investment, the business environment, our capital building, our capital acceptance, our project acceptance is being driven by the interest rate environment, which could be driven by the Treasury's need for capital? That's what we're facing here. Notice something else that's really perverse about this. Notice that as the capital markets get squeezed more and more, and this is a little bit advanced for you, but you probably get it. You notice that this company, see this project C? It's a low expected return project, but that probably means it's a very safe project. It doesn't yield much, but it doesn't put much risk on the company. But as you go up the line, obviously by the time you get to project A, that's going to yield you a lot. You don't get something for nothing. So at 16%, that's going to be probably a pretty risky project. Notice how, as the prevailing interest rate environment kicks upward, that not only kills off business activity, but businesses begin to move towards riskier and riskier projects. They move toward what I call the Hail Marys, because that's the only ones that would yield enough to make it worth borrowing. So essentially, if you think of a company as a portfolio, an investment portfolio of projects of different returns, just like you would buy a portfolio of stocks of different returns, in a rising interest rate environment, the portfolio of the company's projects has a tendency to tilt towards riskier and riskier projects. But that's a bad sign, because risk, here's the thing about risk. Sometimes risk bites you in the ass, okay? You know, you can take risk but expect a high return, but that doesn't mean you're going to get it. You could also get slapped around the room.
So what that means is that not only is the our company tending towards riskier projects, but you're also going to see more companies getting their butts kicked because they took riskier projects. It becomes almost like a death cycle in an economy. As the economy's interest rates push upward, that drives out safer projects from companies' portfolios of projects, and then they're left with riskier projects, which have a higher probability of dying, which means that you have a higher probability of companies going bankrupt. You got the idea? So that's why you have, and that's in our modern theory of government intervention, the government needs to step in at some point here and say, whoa. This is the kind of thing that can get to be a rolling cycle, a lot of trouble. One of the things that can happen that will abate this process is if the Federal Reserve steps in and monetizes, pours money into the economy to push interest rates back down so that businesses can gather, gobble up, and do more projects and get back underway. Right now, one of the key interest rates we talk about, and I'll bring this up in just a minute, is the federal funds rate. Does anyone know what the Fed, just out of curiosity, does anyone know what the Fed funds rate is right now? It's actually about zero. That's right, 0%. In fact, there are some instruments that are yielding negative. In my lifetime, I never thought I'd see this, but it's actually the case that in some situations, I've talked to money managers who said they calculated what their investments, government investments, were yielding when they bought them at the beginning of the day, what they were yielding. They found negative numbers, which essentially means that you are paying the government to lend it money. In an environment like that, essentially what the Fed is doing is it's trying to drive this process down to 0% for government borrowing, which would mean that business borrowing would not be much higher than 0%. The theory there being, of course, that that means that businesses can get underway and take on very low-yielding projects as well as higher-yielding projects, and that will get the economy moving again. That's the basic theory. Is it going to work? Well, there's one little problem with it. As the Fed prints money, it creates more and more of the possibility of a terrible inflation down the road. And that's what I'm predicting we will eventually get, is a very bad inflation, because the Fed was trying to print money for a long time to rescue the government from its excessive borrowings. Now the government's printing money like there's no tomorrow. Enough of that. First rule, first principle of finance. As price goes down on a debt instrument, yield goes up. Price goes down, yield goes up. Does not matter if it's one of these simple discount bills or if it's a very complex bond. All other things being equal, price goes down, yield goes up. And I also sneaked in the second principle there too, which I had already stated before. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return, all other things being equal. If you expect a higher return, you have to bear a greater risk. So the company that takes on project A expecting a 16% return, it must bear a considerably larger risk than it would in accepting project C, which delivers only a 4% rate of return. The riskier things you do in life had better pay off. You at least expect them to pay off better for you. And that's simply, and that rule pervades human behavior, and it pervades the financial markets. If you want a higher yield, you had better be willing to take a higher risk for it. This is where the folly of every year we have these financial news shows that lionize the money market, the mutual fund managers who had the highest returns on their mutual fund portfolios for the year. Let's give them a round of applause and a pat on the butt. There is nothing about that that is heroic. Any hoe handle can get a higher return by bearing a higher risk. That's how you do it. You're not getting it free. You are bearing a risk to get it. And no investor who has any brain at all
would believe differently. So when they take this money, well, this young stud here, his mutual fund had a yield last year of 28%. Isn't he an incredible genius? No, he's not. This mofo took on huge risk. Good for you. I don't want to take on that risk. This gives you a window. You heard the story of Bernie Madoff, the guy who cheated all these rich investors out of billions of dollars of their money, promising them very high returns. And of course, they thought this was a real secret. Only us rich people are allowed to do these kinds of things. And so they were investing for years and years, and they all got creamed eventually. Well, surprise, surprise. You thought you deserved these insanely high rates of return that no normal mortal could get? You thought, what was that, privilege? You're better? Jesus loves you more? No, you were bearing a massive risk. You should have known that. It had nothing to do with how wonderful you are. You took a risk. You got your ass kicked. And now they're in the media, crocodile tears. He wiped out all my investments. Well, you should not have invested in something like that. That's as brutal as I can get. You can't have mercy when people want to blow their money on highly risky things. Well, that's what's going to happen. Now, let me, just a few words here. And like I said, I'm going to cabin this conversation just to the Federal Reserve System, bridging over into Chapter 3 where we talk about the intermediaries, the financial intermediaries themselves. The biggest of the financial intermediaries is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve System was authorized by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. In the 1800s, especially in the later part of the 1800s, the banking system was sort of a wild west. Pretty crazy kind of stuff. Banks were actually, in some periods, issuing their own currencies. The federal government actually did not have a currency of its own, except for a short period of time after World War, I believe it was shortly after World War II, the Civil War, so it could pay off the debts of the Civil War. But generally speaking, in the 1800s, in the later 1800s, there was not a central currency per se, except for these floating debt obligations of the government. But the banks were just having a wild west. And it was a disaster because in a banking system like ours, which I will get into on Monday or on Tuesday, we have a fractional reserve system. If you deposit $100 in my bank, I don't put that $100 in the vault and wait for you to come back. I lend it out because I make money on the interest. If I get $100 from you and I lend it to you, then you're going to deposit with me. I get my $100 back. I lend it to you. You deposit. And you get that. You buy something from her. She deposits $100 with me. Do you see how I can multiply the money, that $100, just like a wildfire? Well, clearly, it would be logical to have a fractional reserve system involved, where I have to keep at least some of that money on reserve, because what would happen if you came back in and said, I'd like $20 of my money? I don't have it. So it would be logical to impose, either through self-discipline on my part or through some government authority, a requirement that a fraction of the money be retained in the bank's vault. Unfortunately, back in the 1800s, that was more easier said than done. It is so tempting to lend it all out or to blow it all on scams or whatever. And so there were what we had called bank runs. See, I might be a very responsible banker. I might keep, let's say, 20% of what you deposit. In case you come back, or in case someone has a check from you, comes back $20, I can pay it. Not a big thing. But then there were irresponsible bankers who just said, screw that, I'm going to just lend out the whole $100. So what would happen is, if you were one of those, you'd gotten a deposit from her of $100. You didn't keep a penny of it. You just lent it right out to you. You come back in for your $20, you've gone bankrupt. Right there. You are out of business. Dead. What would happen is, you would have these, something like that would happen with disreputable banks. And of course, everyone would go wild. There would be a panic. I'll run on that bank. Give me my money. I don't have it. And they, of course, hang you in the street. But then people would hear, you hear that bank went out of business? They didn't have any money. So suddenly everyone is panicking, comes to my bank. Well, you come to my bank for your money back, and I've got it in the vault. You know, I've got a fraction of the money on deposit, and it's still in the vault. Okay, but then you come in. I want my money too. So you don't have any money either. No, it's not like that. You know, he sucked. I don't really. But then he can't pay me back. You come in and demand your money. I go under even though I was responsible. So you can see how a banking system can just implode because of you, you irresponsible person. Things like this happened in the later 1800s. These bank runs were just tearing up the financial system. What could people do about it? Your money, gone. Just gone. There was no government safety net. There was nothing, you know. There was nothing there. So the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 said, all right, we've got to stop this nonsense. This is ridiculous. And so they put in place a central bank, the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve was charged. The Federal Reserve Act created the Federal Reserve and gave the Federal Reserve broad authority over the federal banking system of the United States. Now, there's a concept called federalism where the federal government recognizes that states have rights too. So there was also a parallel state banking system. There would be federal banks that would be overseen by the federal government through the Federal Reserve. And then there would be state chartered banks that would be overseen by the states through their regulatory mechanisms. Interestingly enough, and I've really only tangentially dealt in the banking system, but I know people in the banking system, I had always blasted in class, well, you know, when the federal regulators come in, you're shaking your boots, you know, for their audits or their something like that. And I had this former bank president say, no, we shook in our boots when the state regulators came in. The feds were pretty cool. The state regulators were the ones that were the assholes. Because you had these politically upwardly mobile, sometimes not well-educated idiots at the state level who were there to show how butch they were. He said, we were far more afraid of the state regulators than we were of the Fed. The Fed people were educated, seasoned, urbane, and they would come in and everything was very diplomatic, sort of a collegiality. Those state regulators, he said some of them came in and they would use obscenity sometimes. They would be bullying in what you're going to bring this out right now. I want to see it. And he said it really was better. You actually looked forward to the Fed regulators more than you did state regulators. But anyway, the system sounds clean in one sense. You have the Federal Reserve System, which oversees the federally chartered banks, the big federal banks, the national banks and all that kind of stuff. And then you have these banks that are at the state level, which would be overseen by the state organizations. But unfortunately, the banking system, the financial intermediary system, is not that simple. There are federal banks, federally chartered banks. There are state chartered banks. But then you've got all of these other animals. You have one of my favorites are what are called mutual banks. They're kind of cool. They used to be around a lot more than they are now, and I think it would be wonderful if we could foster legislation and maybe encourage these to come back. A mutual bank is actually owned by its depositors. When you go in and say, I want to have a checking account, they actually review you to see if you qualify as an owner. If they say yes, when you make your deposit, that means that you become an equity owner of the bank, in a sense. Boy, you watch your bank like a hawk. Let me ask you this, real quick. Do you have a checking account? What are the assets of the bank? Let's start with the tier one. What are the tier one assets of your bank? You don't know. Why would you want to know? But if you're an owner, and it's your bank, I mean, really, you are an equity owner, you have a say. You can actually go to a shareholders meeting and see to it that the bank president gets his ass fired if he doesn't do right. Can you do that right now with your bank?
See, these mutual banks are actually very cool animals. They were around in my time quite a bit, and I see a few of mutual banks around, but you don't see them. You also have community banks. You also have credit unions. You also have these savings and loans, what we call thrifts. You have building and loans. They aren't so common anymore, but there are still a few building and loans around. You have all these different financial intermediaries. And so, as you recall, I recommended that you look at figure 3.3-2. That gives you an idea. What had happened was, over this long period of the 20th century, you had had all these different kinds of financial intermediaries developing. Some just kind of disappeared because they weren't too popular. They had fundamental theoretical flaws or practical impediments to growth. But as time went on, it became this crazy quilt of regulatory authority over these different financial intermediaries. That's what brings us to the 21st century in the last couple of years. Who had authority over this set of banks that is dying? Well, we sort of did, but they did too. They had more authority than we did. Well, okay, who's responsible? And everyone kind of steps back, and quite honestly, they can say, well, it really wasn't exactly us that was responsible. And then you put on top of that another layer, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. Which guarantees depositors. That gives you more assurance that if your bank goes belly up, you'll get your deposit back. Now, it's been going up over time. I believe now it's $100,000. You're guaranteed. So when you put that $100,000 in the bank and the bank goes bankrupt, you're going to get your $100,000 back. And I'm sure that makes you feel very good because you were planning to do that, right? $100,000. But there's actually some argument that as you allow that insurance level to go up and up and up, it gives people less and less incentive to worry about their bank, to think about where they are going to do their banking. So there is that, what we call in insurance, that moral hazard. With upping the insurance level, why would you care? Why would you really care what happens? Because your bank, we've had banks in this area that have just gone belly up very recently, right here in this nearby, near this town, right in town, some of its branches, just went belly up. What happened to the people who were depositors there, had checking accounts, savings accounts there? Nothing. They just went to the bank the next, they closed them on Friday. They went, oh, new sign. And the FDIC had guaranteed the deposits and seen to it that there was a sale of the bank to a healthier bank. You saw no pain. No one who had a deposit of $100,000 or less feels any pain from these banks going belly up. So why should people be cautious and learn about financial statements enough to look at a bank? It was so obvious. You look at these banks that are failing all over the place. If you just look at them, where's your tier one capital? Well, you don't have much. I'm not going to put any money in there. No one bothers to do that. And of course, that means that the bank loses really hardly any incentive if the regulators aren't bitching at it. The bank loses huge incentive to be cautious with its money. Its depositors don't care. The regulators don't care. By the way, the FDIC, we have had more bank failures this year, so far this year, than I believe recorded. 77 so far this year. The one there was a cluster of four that failed last week. The biggest of them, Colonial, out of the North Carolina, I think it was, had branches in Alabama, Florida, the Carolinas, all that, hit the FDIC for $2.7 billion alone. That one bank going belly up. A bank that was somewhat smaller than Colonial was sold to a heavier bank. And you're starting to see these banks, when there aren't any healthy banks in the United States that will absorb a dead bank for the feds, then, of course, who are you going to go to? You're going to go to the foreigners who are, oh, yeah, we'll buy you a bank. We just love to have some banking companies here in the United States. And the question becomes, do you really, really want the banking system controlled even in a small part by the Chinese? Do you really, really want that? Well, it's going to happen.
the feds will go to whomever there is that would buy a bank if they can't find anyone. The second of the big dog of the dogs that failed last week, the feds couldn't even find a buyer. The thing was so in such awful shape. It was in such horrible shape. And so the feds just simply had to pay off all the depositors straight up and just shut down the branches. And hope developers will come in and plow them under someday and put up a shopping mall. That was that bad. Now, here's the kicker. The FDIC, I mentioned this about a week ago on a sidebar comment at my main website, and you're starting to see it in the news. The FDIC is coming close to insolvency. It's going to have a bailout. In other words, the insurance premiums haven't kept up, and the FDIC is running out of money to bail out banks. It's running out. So we're going to have a bailout. You'll start hearing about it seriously in the news in a couple of weeks. The Congress is being asked to provide a bailout for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation because the FDIC has run out of money. Now think about the other thing, and I read this just last week from a bank president. All banks have to buy insurance with the FDIC. You pay an insurance premium, right? Good. Okay, suppose that you are a good banker. You've maintained strict adherence to the principles of conservative financial management. You have even had me come in and growl at you when you went out and bought a new set of flowers for the bank's lobby. That's too much money to spend. You have done things right. You have a conservative bank. It's grown conservatively. Your customers love your banking services. You don't offer the moon. You just offer solid day-in, day-out service. Years you've done this, okay? You're a good bank. You've got Mr. Irresponsible here. His bank goes belly up. Your bank goes belly up. Your bank goes belly up. What does the FDIC have to do to insurance premiums on all banks as banks are going belly up? What's it going to do to the insurance premiums? It's going to have to raise them on you. The person, the bank that was responsible, well, yeah, but everyone else will have to pay more. Well, oh, they're all out of business. They've already died. They've already gone home to Jesus. They don't have to pay those higher premiums. You do. For being responsible, you have to pay the price for their irresponsibility. How does that make you feel as a banker? Doesn't make you feel good, does it? It just pisses you off. And politically, sooner or later, the banks that are smart, the banks that are good, the banks that are conservative, begin to reach out into the political sphere and they say, we need a better way here. We don't need this candy being handed out to all of the fools. Okay? I'm going to tell you a secret here. I smoke. I eat fatty foods. I mean, you give me a tub of lard and you heat it up so it's kind of juicy, I'll eat it. I'm in your health insurance company's company. Your premiums are going to go up when I have my first heart attack. You know what's going to happen when I have my first heart attack? They're going to wheel me into the emergency room. The doctor is going to say to me, when did this start? About an hour ago. Okay, are you a smoker? I quit. When did you quit? About an hour ago. How are you going to feel about your premiums going up because of me?
He's happy.
Yeah, you're not going to like it. I'm going to just love myself this. I'm going to love this. You see, because I'm going to, as the irresponsible banks, I'm going to like it because the responsible banks are bearing part of the payments for my irresponsibility. And that's a question that has to be dealt with sooner or later by the politicians, because if they don't, the responsible banks are going to reach into the political environment and they're going to see to it that the right politicians are elected who aren't stupid enough to let this kind of system go on any further. This is a good time cleaning out these bad banks and giving you the incentive to get pissed off about the banking system as it has existed, the FDIC as it has existed. Now, I'm going to go on with this on Tuesday, but I think I'll let it off for today. And that's all I have for you today. I thank you.